Good morning. It's good to see everybody here. We are grateful for everybody's presence, but especially the visitors that we have. And I think this is the week for Arkansas camp. So we should have a larger crowd than usual. For those of you who are expecting Bruce to be here, I'm sorry. He's not. He's in Topeka, Kansas for the gospel meeting. And he's asked me to substitute for him this morning. As I thought about what to work with today, I looked at several different things. A couple of parables that Jesus had. And as I wrapped up what I was talking about, we're going to be in Luke, the 12th chapter, so you can turn there if you'd like to. We'll start in a few minutes. It seems like several of those parables, or stories, if you want to call them that, come back to a central thought. And we will deal with that today in the story of the rich man. Jesus is talking with his disciples in the beginning of chapter 12 and telling them a lot of things that are going to be. And as he gets down to verse 13, something happens as he's speaking to them. By the way, can everybody hear me okay? Okay. Should have asked that first, I guess. As it gets to that point, a member of the audience says something to him. And look at verse 13. It says, "And one of the company said unto him, Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me." Here was a man, and I'm going to assume that he is a Jew, who wants the Lord to do something for him that Jesus is not going to be inclined to do. And I don't think Jesus, at that point in time, although Jesus has all authority, I understand, is not here for that purpose and doesn't have, as far as the Jews would be concerned, the right to do what this guy is asking him to do. What it deals with here is the inheritance that this man is going to get, or hasn't gotten, as the case may be. And it's the inheritance from, apparently, their father. And we have to assume that there are only two sons that are involved in this, that there are two. And that will kind of make it a little bit easier. And you have to wonder, okay, what's going on here? And I could think of two possibilities. One is that the first son, and I'm going to assume that this is not the older brother. This is the younger brother, the younger of the two sons. That the other son has taken everything. And this guy's saying, make him give me my part. And I don't think that's the case because of what the Lord says. The other case is that he's gotten his inheritance. And he's not happy with what he's gotten. Turn to Deuteronomy, the 21st chapter. God set a law into effect back then. Deuteronomy 21. And in this case here, he's going to speak about it in regards to a man who has two wives. But at the end of it, he will talk about a right that is there. So if a man hath two wives, and one beloved and the other hated, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be hers that was hated, then it shall be when he maketh his sons to inherit that which he hath, that he may not make the son of the beloved firstborn become the son before the son of the hated, which is indeed the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the son of the hated for the firstborn by giving him a double portion of all that he hath, for he is the beginning of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. And that's what the law says. That's all that is said here about the right of the firstborn. But it's a double portion. And as we go back and look at that, you'll see back in time, if you went back and looked through the Old Testament, that as the men, and Jacob was one of them, he did the same thing. He had 12 sons. He had to give a double portion to one, and that went to Joseph, because I think Reuben was the firstborn who had committed sin. And then you go back to Isaac. Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Esau was the firstborn, but he sold his birthright, the right he had to the double portion, so he could get a meal from Jacob. And so that right went to him. Of course, and then the trickery that Jacob went through to get that, to get his father to bless him, was also part of it. But the right of the firstborn went to him in the case here. But that's not what we're dealing with here. We're apparently dealing with a man who has gotten his inheritance. He's gotten his part. Now, if you wanted to look at, the women were not included. This is talking about sons, because a daughter would not inherit unless it was, I think, just only daughters there. And that was dealt with in another place. So we're talking about the sons here, and they would take and add another portion. You have two sons, you take another portion, throw it in, you have three, and two-thirds would go to the firstborn, and one-third would go to the secondborn. This man's not happy. And he says, "Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me. Tell him to give me part of his inheritance." And look at what Jesus says there. He says, and he said unto him, "Man, who made me a judge or a divider over you?" That's not what I'm here to do. They had courts. They had the big Sanhedrin, and they had a smaller Sanhedrin in some of the other cities. And that's what those men were there for, to judge righteously, hopefully, between the things that would come up. And this being a matter of law, if it were the first instance that we talked about, that you have a brother who's taken all the inheritance, he's not giving any, then the court, there would be no doubt about that one. You know, he'd have to give a third of it to his brother. But if this man went to the courts, he wouldn't get anything at all in this case here, because he's already got his third. He wouldn't be entitled to anything else, because the right of the firstborn went to the firstborn. And he's wanting something different than what he has. And it's interesting what Jesus says there in the next verse, in verse 15. "And he said unto them, Take heed and be aware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." And as I was wrapping up things, and I had looked at other parables, one of them being the unjust steward. And at the very end of that one, it's, you know, God, you cannot serve God and mammon. You can't seek to serve God and serve riches or getting of wealth. They don't go together. And that's what this man was after. He was after getting things. I want something. I want something that's not mine. I want what you have. What does covetous mean? Somebody, what are we talking about when we talk about covetousness? Greed. Greed is a very good word. The Greek word that goes back there means avarice, which goes to greed. It is excessive or insatiable desire for wealth or gain. That's the Webster's definition of the word avarice. It includes greediness and cupidity. And as I saw that, I thought, what in the world is cupidity? Because you see the first word being Cupid. And so I had to click and see. And it says, the inordinate desire for wealth, strong desire or lust. Strong desire or lust. This man was lusting after something that his brother had. Thayer defines the word as greedy desire to have more, covetousness, avarice. Strong defines it as avarice, that is, by implication, fraudulently, extortion, covetousness, covetous practices, greediness from holding or desiring more, that is, eager for gain, And it comes, avaricious, hence a defrauder. That's what I thought was interesting. The word fraudulent and defrauder come up with regards to the word covetousness. And I would never have put some of those words together, although thinking about them, yeah, they are. Because we're not thinking of being a defraud, we're defrauding somebody, but if you want to take something that doesn't belong to you, that if I think Todd, I'm thankful that Todd's not my brother, he's probably glad too, that if he had something that I wanted that's not mine to have, like this son here wanted from his brother, if I take it from Todd, what have I done? I've defrauded Todd of his possessions. And so those words go together, and they do seem to fit. And I was talking with Ben about this a few minutes before, that as you wrap up and you look at the parable in Luke 16 about the rich man and Lazarus, what did the rich man have? He had wealth that was beyond we can understand. And if you think about what Sean Chancellor talked about on his Sunday morning when he was here, that's what he talked about, the wealth was unreal. And he built up that wealth. He got that wealth. And he did not think about or didn't even see Lazarus sitting at his gate. The unjust steward who is misusing his bosses, I'm going to use, his owners, things in a way that he is gaining from that. And then the end of that parable, it says, you cannot serve God and mammon or riches. So a lot of times when we look at this, even though we may think that we're not guilty of covetousness, that maybe we are. And so I want to spend a little bit of time looking at this parable, and then we'll make some applications, hopefully, at the end of it. And he said a parable unto them in verse 16, saying, the ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully, and he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God said unto him, thou fool, this night thy soul shall be required of these, and then whose shall these things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. As you go through that, we're going to look at some of the things that this rich man does. He's a very rich man as well. And if you go back to the society that the Jews lived in, what did they think about a rich man? Was this... Oh, I'm sorry? But what else did that denote to him besides power? Blessing by God. He was blessed by God because he had all this wealth. And so whenever Jesus tells the disciples that it's hard for a rich man to enter into heaven, what did they think? Wait a minute, Lord. If a rich man's not saved, what happens to the rest of us? They had their sense turned upside down, because it is God that gives us wealth. God gives us the ability to get wealth. And he talks about that, and we'll look at that verse later, things that say that. But it's not the accumulation of what Jesus is saying. It's not the accumulation of wealth. Go back to what he says there in verse 15. He says, take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life, his true life, what he really is, doesn't consist in the abundance of things which he possesseth. Our life, our true life, who we really are, is not going, the abundance of things is not going to matter. You know, and we like to look and think, I have this, I own this, I have that. And a few years ago, we had some lessons on stewardship. And those of you that sat through that with me, bless your hearts. But some of the things that, and I didn't put that together, that was a friend of mine had done that, and I thought it was very well done. There were five things that we talked about with stewardship, and that's going to come into this man's play as well. The first one was that everything belongs to God. And so the things that we get don't belong to us anyhow. Because the first one is everything belongs to God. The second one was nothing belongs to me. Okay, once I establish that, then there's a thing there. But then one of the other ones was that God has given me a part of his estate for me to have while I'm here. And he's given me instructions on what I'm to do with that part. And then the last thing is that I will be judged on how I have done my work as a steward. And I'm not so much worried about stewardship, although, I mean, this guy's got that same problem. And we will have the same problem. But if we're saying, okay, that these are going to be mine, they're not. They're going to be God's. But our life doesn't consist of what our real life doesn't consist of that. But it said, this man said within himself, go back to verse 16, I'm sorry. The ground of a certain rich man brought forth plentifully. What part did the rich man have in that? Yeah, he planted it. Yeah, he had people that took care of it for him. But if he doesn't get the rains that he needs, can he change that? Well, he can irrigate somewhat, yeah, but God gave that abundance to him, and he didn't think about that. Because look at the next verses. He says, and he thought within himself, what shall I do? Now, if you look through this, he's going to say I six times. In my, he's going to say five times. What shall I do, because I have no room where to bestow my fruits? This, he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods, and I will say to my soul, so that, excuse me, now as much goods laid up for many years, take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. If the accumulation of wealth is all that there was, this man had it. He had it. And look at the end there. He says, I've got it laid up. I don't have to work anymore. He wasn't working anyhow. He was having all of it farmed out. But the point was, he didn't need any more. And if you go through the first part of this thing, and we will look at it a little bit closer there, when he goes to this point and says, the grounds brought forth plentifully, there was much, he had excess, and he said, you know, what will I do? I don't have room to put this stuff. I'll have to tear down my barns. I'll have to build bigger barns. I'll have to have more granaries. Was there anything wrong with that? No. No. He could have done some other things with it and had less of it, but the fact that he had it and the fact that he was making provisions for that to be stored for future use or for current use, there's nothing wrong with that. We should be planning for things. We need to have, whenever times are good, is put some away, maybe. But this man didn't have that problem. There weren't lean times as far as he was concerned. They were good times. And so he it's not a problem with him tearing down his barns and building new barns. That's great. That's good. But he leaves God out of the equation. And it's all focused on me. What shall I do? What could he have done? Having all this grain, or all of whatever it was that he had. He talks about fruits there, and there's two different words for fruits. One of them that he first talks about is the stuff he gets, but the second one, the last one down there, is I will bestow all my fruits and my goods. Those goods are, his fruits are his offspring, the things that come from him. He's provided for himself, and he's provided for his offspring. Did he think about his neighbor? Did he think about an offering to God, a peace offering that we talked about in Samuel, where you were encouraged to bring, invite the Levites, invite the poor, the widows, those that are in need, and you share a tenth of what you have with them. Give them part of it. Well, not a tenth. That was another one. They had to do that. There was part of the tithing was one of those that they had to do. But whenever you brought a peace offering, you were expected to take part of that offering, eat it, and share it with others. And if you had things like this, you were expected to take care of your brother, your neighbor. But this man didn't think about that. He didn't think about God helping him get to this point. It's all me, my, mine, I. Yeah, he'd fit in this generation real well today, wouldn't he? Don't we live in the me generation to some extent? And it's all instant. I want what I want, and I want it now. Don't we even deal with the Lord that way? Lord, I want my stuff, and I want it now. I've been guilty of that, and I sometimes think in my prayers, and this goes back to a long time ago when something in my life, when my father passed away, and my mother, being in her 50s, being a widow. And, you know, if you look at it from the standpoint of there are not a lot, men die older, men die younger as a rule, and you have a lot of ladies left. That the pool from which to pick or to have a person for her to marry is smaller than if it were the other way around. And I wondered, and in praying, Lord, you know, help Mom find somebody. And I remember thinking that, you know, this is taking a couple of years to go on, and I'm going, what's happening? You know, I wanted this to happen soon. Well, it did take place, and when it did, I had the chance to look back at it and think, you know, Roger, you're selfish. Although I wanted it for my mom, I still wanted it for me. It would help her out. The things that had to happen for that to take place. And she did. She met a very fine man, a Christian, who just passed away, you know, last month. And we get so wrapped up in what I want, and I want it, and I want it now. And we sing a song, teach me, Lord, to wait. The future, there's a waiting process, not to say I have to have things now. This man had it. He had all of it, and he had it right then. He didn't start out that way, but he did take that. But he says, what shall I do? I'll tear down my barns, build bigger, better barns, and I'll bestow my goods. He forgot about other people. He forgot that a man is more than what he owns. You know, we look at people that are wealthy. And the wealth that we're talked about here in these verses and throughout the Bible, when they talk about rich men, they're talking about people that, as my wife sometimes says, they don't breathe the same air we breathe. They're at a different level of things. And one thing that comes to my mind as the NBA finals are coming up, that you have players there that are making unreal amounts of money. Fame, fortune. For what? Tossing a ball through a hoop? I think our values are a little bit skewed. Although I have to admit, I got one team in my sights and hope that they do well, but I won't get anything from it. But we're not what we can see. We're not, our being is not what we have. Turn to Psalms, the 24th chapter. Psalms 24, the very first verse there states that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But he doesn't stop there. And they that dwell therein. Everything belongs to God. It's not what I come up with. It's God. And if you go back to Ecclesiastes, at the end of Ecclesiastes, it said, consider the whole matter, fear God, and keep his commandments, for this is the whole of man. My purpose isn't here to the accumulation of wealth. And we'll deal with that with Ecclesiastes a little bit later. It's to serve God. His glory. His goodness. I belong to God. Everything I have belongs to God. Because I have to go back in my mind to those 5 points of stewardship, that the second one is that nothing belongs to me. But I have to take care of what I have. Turn to Deuteronomy, the 10th chapter. It's a very similar reading there, but Deuteronomy 10. Verse 14, it says, "Behold, the heavens and the heaven of heavens is the Lord thy God's, the earth also, and they that, and all that therein is." In other words, I'm just trying to get to across the point to us that even if you amassed all this stuff, like this man did, it's not yours. It's not mine. I've got very little. You know, and in some ways, I have tremendous amounts compared to people in other nations, compared to what my parents had. We're extremely blessed. Extremely blessed. And as Americans, we more so than a lot of other places. But it's not mine. Don't ever get to thinking that it's yours, because you can lose it in an instant. The source of happiness. This man didn't realize that the source of real happiness isn't in wealth. Turn to 1 Timothy, the 6th chapter. Paul says this and it deals with happiness and contentment. In verse 6 there, 1 Timothy 6 and 6, "But godliness with contentment," excuse me, "is great gain." What? Godliness with contentment. And Paul at one point said, I've learned to be happy with whatever I have. Basically, you know, Paul went through a whole, you know, he had it all, he gave it up, and then he suffered greatly for the cause of Christ. But then he speaks to Philippians of joy. He didn't have anything. Didn't have to. Joy and happiness are not based on what we have. And we've talked about this part, that this rich man forgot that God, he forgot God. Let's just say that. He just forgot God. God didn't enter into his equation. He didn't enter into his life as far as what he was going to do with this. Instead of saying, you know, the Lord blessed me with this stuff. He's given it to me. I've been blessed by him, and I need to do something with it. No. It's 6 times, it's my stuff. Forget God. God's not part of it. You know, Jesus even talked about those things. Let's go to Deuteronomy first. Deuteronomy, the 8th chapter. Verse 18. Forgetting God, here's what he forgets this, that, "But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth." What? Lord says, "I'm giving this to you." What happened to Job? When Job lost everything. His family, his wealth, everything. And God gave him more afterwards when he was proven righteous. The rich people in the Bible, Abraham was a very rich man. Isaac, Jacob, Esau, I think they all were. They were all wealthy men. They got the blessings of God. It comes from God. But we have to realize that the idea that a richer a person is not makes him godly. And sometimes it ends up being just the opposite. Matthew 19, this is where I was headed for whenever something else struck me. But Matthew 19, Jesus has talked about this in verses 23 through, because of the rich man there. He starts there and he says, "Verily I say unto his disciples that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God." And his disciples heard it. Wait a minute, Lord. They said, they were exceedingly amazed, saying, "Then who can be saved? If this rich man isn't saved by his wealth, and he's not righteous because he has it, then what about us?" rich man also forgot something else that happens. And at the end, let's go back to Luke 12. And after he's gone through this and he's going to tear down his barns, build new barns, bigger barns, probably better barns. He says in 19, I will say to my soul, so you have many goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And that's not the important part. It's nice for a man to enjoy what he has. But it's the last statement there, the one after that, that says, and the Lord said unto him, thou fool. You foolish person. You left me out of the equation. You left your neighbors out of the equation. You've centered totally on you. He said, now, this night, your soul shall be required of you. Death comes. It's going to come to all of us if we live long enough. If the Lord doesn't return, we will all die. If he doesn't come before we die, then we will die. However that comes out to be. And we don't have an idea when that's going to happen. My stepfather passed away in his sleep about a month ago. Sister Busby's daughter passed away in her sleep last week. They didn't know that was going to happen. We all lose people. We can't determine unless we take our own life, and that's not where we want to go, the time of our death. He'll come as the Lord says he'll come as a thief in the night. Now, whether that means that he's going to return or that we will die that way, it doesn't matter how you want to view that. We don't control that. There are things that are totally out of our control. And this man forgot about that. He said, I've got it all. I don't have to work. I don't have to sow anything else. I mean, what I've got will continue. I can have people do it. And I think about those ball players. I think about people that have just huge amounts of wealth that can just jet around the world if they want to. Do they think about God? Do they think about death coming? Because what happens then? Can you take it with you? I heard the story. I'm sure it's just story, and that's all it is that, you know, a man died and he wanted him to put his wife to put all of his money in his casket with him, take it with him. When afterwards they asked about it, he said, I wrote a check and put it in there. She kept it. You know, and you could ask whenever a rich man dies, or any of us. But we tend to think of it when a wealthy person passes that, I wonder how much he left. He left it all. Because we can't take it with us. We brought nothing into this world and we will take nothing out. And other than what we do here for the Lord, for ourselves, for the world, The world in itself will not know that I've been here. The overall world. And most of us the same way. Because we live normal lives. We're normal people. Bill Gates will be known for years. Warren Buffett will be. Roger Perry won't be. Not in the extent that they are. But hopefully I've made an impression in this life different than what this man is that did here. He forgot that when death comes, he won't take it with him. Ecclesiastes, the second chapter, Solomon. Solomon struggled with things. He looked at them, and they just didn't make sense. And in the second chapter, he mentions there, and we're going to talk about it for just a couple of verses there. Verse 22, he says, "What man hath of all of his labors and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun?" What man of this? Take a man who labors, and he gets all this stuff. He's labored under the vexation of his heart, and all his days are sorrows, and his travail and grief. He takes no heart, no rest in night. This is vanity. Okay, and on down to 24. "There is nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good of his labor. This also I saw, for it was from the hand of God. And who can eat, and who else can I hasten unto?" And I really got myself out of order there. Go back to verse 22, I'm sorry. "For what man hath of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrow, and his grief, his travail grief, he taketh no rest in the night." This man that has it all, he's going to, first of all, and I didn't get the right verse there, he's going to leave it to somebody, and he doesn't know who it's going to be left to. But if you amassed all that stuff, what is this man back over here in Luke, the 12th chapter, thinking? Does he just put it up in a barn and say, "Okay, I don't have to worry about it anymore"? No, he's worried about people stealing it from him, taking it. He may not have a good insurance man. I didn't know if they had insurance men back then. But it's a constant thing of worry to him. And then he leaves it to somebody. He doesn't know who's going to get it when he leaves. We don't realize in some cases that we will stand before... We do. I mean, we realize these things. But he didn't realize that he would stand before God. Covetousness is something that was condemned in the Old Testament. It's condemned in the New Testament. Of the Ten Commandments, you went through the list of them. Number 10. Turn to Exodus, the 20th chapter. Make our application. Hopefully we can hear. The Lord has given Moses the tablets. And it starts off, you know, with about God and things. And we won't go through all those. But in the 17th verse of the 20th chapter, let me get to the right spot here. He says, "And thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house." Now, if you haven't read this in a while, what would you have thought that the covet that you're not supposed to covet? Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That's what we always remember, isn't it? Tends to be. Well, look what he talks about there in verse 17. "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservants, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's." Don't covet. Don't go take his. What about the New Testament? Mark 7. Look what the Lord said. From within, verse 21, back in verse 20. "For that which cometh out of a man, that defileth a man." Because he was talking about the people that putting things in, they were defiled. He said, no, it's not what goes in, it's what comes out. "For from without of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts." So adultery, this is in verse 21. "Fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lasciviousness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and defile the man." Romans, the first chapter. verses 28 and 29. And in Romans 1, he's talking about how the Gentiles had left God. And he says in there in 28, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whispering, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventions of evil things, disobedient to parent, without understandings, covenant breakers, without natural affections, implacable, unmerciful." Do you see where he put covetousness in there with? Ephesians, the fifth chapter. He talks about here, and he starts the fifth chapter up about being followers of God and walk in love, as in verse 2, as God also hath loved us and hath given himself, Christ has also loved us and given himself in his offering and sacrifice. But he said, "But fornication and uncleanness and covetousness, let it not be named among you as becometh saints." Colossians 3. Verse 5, "Mortify, therefore, your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affections, evil concupiscence, covetousness, which is idolatry." If something that I'm putting before God, that is something that I want to the point that I want it more than anything else, that's an idol. Covetousness is something we need to be on look for. I tend to think we don't have a problem with it, but we probably do. It's some level in our lives, and we need to look at that. I appreciate your comments, and hope you gain something from it.